be able to launch private spacecraft, go into space, come back, and then within 2 weeks do the same thing with the same spacecraft. Definitely did, you know, did that back in June of 2004. Flew out of Mojave, California. So Paul Allen eventually got away from that. Richard Branson took over, and Rick Branson is now owner of Virgin Galactic. Virgin Galactic is an extension of the Spaceship One program. They're developing Spaceship Two. And within probably a couple of weeks or maybe a month or so, I believe they are going to try to get their pilot and co-pilot into space on a very large Spaceship 2 compared to Spaceship 1. Spaceship 1 had just one guy went up, and that was this would be able to carry 8 people, a pilot and co-pilot, and 6 passengers, 6 paying passengers, probably at $250,000 each. So hopefully that goes well, and in a month or so, you might see that on the news. Kind of takes off on a runway. Well, it itself is not taking off on a runway. It's being brought up to 50,000 feet with a carrier jet. The carrier jet is called the White Knight, White Knight 2. White Knight 1 had propellers. White Knight 2 has jets. And of course, it's much bigger, carries the Spaceship 2 up to 50,000 feet. They dropped like a bomb out of a torpedo bank. So off it goes and lights its engine, and we'll go into suborbital space. Not orbit, but suborbital. Who's ever on board will experience about 4 or 5 minutes of zero-G, get the curvature of the Earth, and qualify as being an astronaut because you're going to be going above the common line. Common line is 100 kilometers or 60 miles above the Earth. And one last program Paul Allen got involved with is something called Stratolaunch, which we talked here on the net about. Stratolaunch is a large carrier plane. I mean, really large. The wing tips from one end to the other. Longer than the length of a football field, over 300 feet. And his intention is to fly this thing like the White Knight 2 does, bring a spacecraft attached to it up to 50,000 feet, let it drop, let the spacecraft not go into suborbital conditions, but go into orbit. And that was his goal. He got as far as, you know, Paul Allen got to see the Stratolaunch be pulled out and go on its own with the engines and the runway. He got it up to around 130 kilometers per hour. Each time they tested it, they went faster and faster. And the next test is they're going to try to actually get it off the ground, see how it does, and land it. A couple more tests after that, and eventually by next year they should have this thing in operation. Paul Allen is also a company now starting to develop a rocket engine, which would eventually be put on, you know, they'd be able to put their own rocket on Stratolaunch. But they'll be able to carry other vehicles as well from other, any other companies, including Orbital ATK, now called Northrop Grumman. But Orbital ATK have plans for Paul Allen to launch their vehicle, their spaceship on this thing. He's got long-term plans of eventually possibly putting people on a spacecraft and carrying it up with his carrier jet to that height. A large carrier jet carries 6 Rolls-Royce engines. They're 747 stock, so 747 engines, which is like, I think, 55,000 pounds of thrust each, and six of them attached to a straddle launch carrier, able to launch anything he wants. He'll be able to put anything into orbit he wants to do with that large plane. So that's the story on that. Before I go on, does anybody have any questions on the topic? This is WS1. Okay. Now, last week on that, we had the topic of the two astronauts that tried to make it to the International Space Station, but didn't. They were launched by the Soyuz rocket, the MS-10 rocket, spacecraft that was launched on the Soyuz rocket. And one American and one Russian, Alexei Ovechkin, was commander or pilot of the Soyuz vehicle from Russia, and the American is Nick Haig, happens to be a ham, KG-5TMV. Got up to about roughly, I think it was 30 to 50 kilometers high, and had to abort. What happened was, as they were going up, thought the second stage was going to bring them further, closer to where they need to go into orbit, and something triggered the computer to create an abort. With that, the launch abort system, part of the launch abort system, is this power that sticks out of the front of the rocket, and that normally would pull the first two parts of the Soyuz craft away. The Soyuz spacecraft consists of three parts. One in the front is the orbital module, and the one in the middle is the descent module. That's the one where the astronauts get into and sit in there when they're going uphill, and also when they're back to Earth. And the one behind it is the service module. The service module would stay behind. The launch abort system would pull these other two parts away from the rocket itself that was failing. And because the launch abort system had already separated, they have jettison motors on the launch abort system that pull it away in case if they're not going to use it at all. It pulls the whole system away. That already took place. So that was unable to be used. So what they have is they have four other solid booster rockets that are attached to the fairing itself. The astronaut and cosmonaut cannot see out windows. They're completely covered up by fairings. Fairings are still attached after the launch abort system. Power goes. So the rockets wind up firing on the fairing. That's their second level of defense in case there's an abort. And that pulled them away from the Soyuz rocket. And successfully wound up sending them to a ballistic shot right back down to Earth. Normally they would ride the upper atmosphere, it would be non-ballistic. This was a ballistic shot, which means they spin, they look toward Earth, and they keep rotating kind of like a clock as they go in. They wind up gaining a lot more than the other system, but that's what happens if you have an abort. But they made it back to Kazakhstan fine, good shape, and they're both doing fine. Now, what failed on the on this whole setup? I've been looking into it. There isn't a final report yet, but there's something called the Korolev Cross. Korolev Cross is on the Soyuz rocket. It's really like they consider it a three-stage rocket. The first stage is these four boosters that are attached to the Soyuz rocket, and then the second stage is the core stage. That's the stage that's inside the four boosters. The third stage is the stage above that, the smaller stage that's attached to crew vehicle, the Soyuz spacecraft. So what happens normally is they get up to 3,000-4,000 miles per hour, around 50 kilometers high, and then these four boosters separate from the spacecraft to get rid of weight. So what happens is fall away. If you look at a picture, and there's pictures of these things doing that. You have the top part, the point of the four boosters, pull away from the spacecraft, and they rotate as they go away from the spacecraft. You can see them rotating as they're falling away. And they call that the Korolev Cross. Invented by Korolev. Sergei Korolev was the Russian that came up with a lot of these ideas back in the early 50s to eventually, his goal was to put ICBMs in the continental ballistic missiles into space, but he developed this rocket, the R-7, and they never did that. They never launched any ballistic missiles, but they did use it to launch Soyuz and eventually Yuri Gagarin. But the system really hasn't changed. The rocket got a little bit bigger. The Korolev Cross still is in play. So they think what happened is one of these boosters came back and hit the second stage and damaged it, or whatever reason, the second stage shut itself off, and signaling up and abort for the computers to do what I said before. So he's got an interesting system. The top of the boosters, it's like a ball and joint type of socket for each booster. The top is a ball, and then pushes against a socket that's attached to the rocket itself. So when these things have thrust behind it, the ball is pushing against the socket, which is near the top of the vehicle. And then when the fuel is about to run out, it's still, it's still firing, it's still under pressure. What happens is the bottom parts have these explosive bolts, and they separate from the rocket. Because it's still under thrust, they start to pull out a little bit, and the bottom starts to pull away from the rocket, and then the top, the very top of it, your ball joint, the ball and socket start to pull apart from one another, and then there's a valve right near that ball joint. Valve opens up, oxygen that's normally inside the system starts shooting out of the top, pushing itself away from the rocket. This way they're not using explosive bolts near the tanks of the existing, still running second stage. And that pushes the front of all these boosters completely away from the rocket, and then they start falling in a beautiful design away from the rocket called Korolev Cross. So what they think might have happened is one of these valves on one of the boosters that allows the oxygen that's inside the booster to act as a jet pushing the top part of the rocket away, the top part of the booster away from the second stage. They think that valve maybe failed, didn't open. So because it didn't open, the front part didn't get pulled away, and that particular booster started falling back, and that front part eventually clipped the second stage and creating the abort system that luckily turned out to be successful. This is WS2N. And any comments or questions up until now about Korolev Cross or anything I've covered so far? Okay, one other important topic. I know I've talked about this on the net probably a couple of years intimately. I talked about the mission to Mercury. The Mercury was, from the European Space Agency. The European Space Agency had a plan to send two spacecraft to orbit Mercury. And their launch was very successful on October 19th, last Friday. They took off from Kourou, French Guiana, down in South America on European Space Agency or Ariane 5 rocket. Their big heavy lift rocket. It has on top in the fairing two spacecraft, one built by the European Space Agency and the other one built by the Japanese Space Agency. Their ultimate goal will be from about 7 years from now to get into orbit around Mercury with both spacecraft. One European Space Agency at a lower orbit, and that's going to have all kinds of instruments on board to investigate the planet, certain things that they're interested in, like near the poles. They believe there's still water ice in the craters of Mercury, so it's 800 degrees on that planet overall. But the poles are situated in such a way that they never tilt toward the sun at all, so there could still be water ice in there. They'd like to find that out. We try to find the same information out. We sent Messenger up back in 2004. Messenger was a spacecraft that was launched by NASA, successfully orbited Mercury. Now the European Space Agency and Japan collectively are trying to do the same thing. So that went off successfully. It's called Bepi Colombo. Bepi Colombo was named after this guy who was an Italian astronomer that figured out that Mercury actually revolved around itself. I think it was a 3-to-2 ratio. For every two times it went around the sun, Mercury would revolve three times. He figured that out. He was also the first to say that you could eventually use gravitational assist to slow the spacecraft down to get to Mercury. In this case, they're going to be doing, Bepi Colombo is going to go around the sun, complete orbit, in the process of doing now, and in about a year from now, it's going to come past Earth. Earth is actually going to slow it down and change its trajectory a little bit to go to the inner the planets. With that, it's going to do, I believe, two gravity assists to slow it down with Venus, and then I think at least six more times with the planet Mercury itself before it actually goes into orbit. So pretty exciting mission. Incorporating these ion rockets that are on board to do all this work instead of chemical rockets, so they're able to make these spacecraft a lot smaller, a lot more practical. Has a subsystem, a solar electric propulsion ion rocket. It's got four ion rockets. Able to produce around 4 kilowatts of power when they're on. They don't need four. They would like to have four, but they don't use four. They use two of the rockets. The other two are backups. A lot of people say, well, why don't you just use all four? And you can't, because the solar panels are so big, and they can only get around 4,000 kilowatts out of it. So I guess if they can get 8,000 out of it, maybe they would be able to use all four. But the other two are just a backup in case they fail, given redundancy in the space industry. So that's the story on that thing, and let's see that worked out okay. One other ham-related topic I wanted to just go over real quick. There's a spacecraft that's going to be going to a geosynchronous orbit, and probably in November or so, SpaceX is going to launch Falcon 9 rocket for the country Qatar with a satellite, communications satellite that will go to geosynchronous orbit. But on the satellite, it's going to also have ham radio equipment on board to be able to use as a repeater or a transponder for anybody, I guess, that lives in that area. It's going to leave us out because it's geosynchronous. It's going to be in one location. It'll be at 25 degrees east, so that puts it, you know, out near Saudi Arabia somewhere, or, you know, Qatar, out in the middle of nowhere as far as I'm concerned. So all these different bands, the S-band, 2.4 gigahertz, they're going to use that X-band downlink. I guess it's not going to affect us unless we take a ride out to Thailand or Brazil or someplace to be able to access the repeater at 23,000 miles out. That will be the first amateur radio satellite officially in geosynchronous orbit. That's the deal on that. And that's pretty much it. Anybody have any questions about the space program or anything else? This is Paul for the TechNet, a portion of the TechNet. WS2N. I had one question for Roy, if you're still there. Roy, are you still there? AC2GS, space-related questions.
Yeah, sure, Paul. I'm still here.
Yeah, in your preview, I sent the email back to you. I was wondering about the asteroid redirect type of mission that is being developed. I can't find anything about it. Know about the ARM, that was canceled. They call it ARM, asteroid redirect mission. This apparently must be something new that you were thinking about or read about, Roy. Back to you.
Yeah, it's called the Double Asteroid Redirection Test, and NASA loves acronyms, so they call it DART.
Okay. DART, DART. I'll look that up. Is that anytime soon, and what are they planning on doing? How do they plan on moving this asteroid?
Well, if you want, I could just do the whole spiel, but basically it's in the design, it's in the end of the design and assembly stage, and they say that it should be ready for launch in a few years out. You know, NASA has these long lines of plans for things.
Yeah, that sounds good, because they canceled in Obama's administration. They were planning on going out and grabbing an asteroid, you know, one of these, you know, this thing was going to be like 30 feet in diameter. They were going to grab it with this fraction and fire an engine from liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, they call it RL-10C rocket engine, that they're going to push it from the asteroid belt and put it into lunar orbit. So that, you know, you can imagine why they eventually canceled this thing. It was a little on the expensive side, because it was going to be in lunar orbit, and then they were going to send an Orion spacecraft, which hasn't gone up yet, NASA was, and they were going to launch it on the SLS system, the space launch system, and send it to the moon, dock with this asteroid, and they were going to start, you know, do an EVA, take stuff out of the spacecraft, dig up some rocks from it, you know, with hammers and chisels or whatever they're going to use, and they were going to bring stuff back, put it back in the Orion spacecraft. Needless to say, this got canceled. But just the idea of moving this asteroid from one place to another. It's really fascinating, but that's not going to happen. I'd like to hear the, if you have that, that would be good. You can go through that. I'm finished with all the things I was going to cover. I don't have any other questions that people are asking right now. So back to you, Roy, and unless Dick wants to pick it up. AC2GS, this is WS.
Repeater, timeout.
Well, I would be more than happy if it's okay with Dick.
You got it, Roy.
Okay. Within near-Earth space, there are over 18,000 asteroids. Whose orbit occasionally brings them close to Earth. Over the course of millions of years, some of these near-Earth orbits, NEOs, which range from a few meters to tens of meters in diameter, may even collide with Earth. It is for this reason that the ESA and other space agencies around the world are engaged in coordinated efforts to routinely monitor larger near-Earth objects and track their orbits. In addition, NASA and other space agencies have been developing countermeasures in case any of these objects stray too close to our planet in the future. One proposal is NASA's Double Asteroid Redirection Test, DART, the world's first spacecraft specifically designed to deflect incoming asteroids. This spacecraft recently moved into its final stage of design and assembly and will launch to space in a few years. Let me drop for a sec. The Double Asteroid Redirection Test was designed and built by the Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Laboratory with support from NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, Goddard Space Flight Center, and the Johnson Space Center. This mission will test the kinetic impactor technique, which consists of striking an asteroid to shift its orbit and deflect it away from the Earth, thus demonstrating our ability to protect our planet from a potential impact. At present, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test mission's launch ranges from late December 2020 to May 2021. Once it reaches space, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test will rendezvous with the binary asteroid known as Didymos, which is Greek for twin, which consists of Didymos A, which measures about 800 meters, a half a mile in diameter, and the moonlit Didymos B, which orbits A and is about 530 feet in diameter. The Double Asteroid Redirection Test spacecraft will rely on evolutionary xenon thruster, commercial a solar electric propulsion system similar to what Dawn spacecraft used to reach the main asteroid belt. This thruster system will not only reduce the overall weight of the spacecraft, it will also allow for a significant degree of flexibility with the mission timeline and launch window. Let me drop for a second. Once in space, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test will gradually spiral out beyond the orbit of the Moon to escape Earth's gravitational pull and then fly towards Didymos. It will intercept Didymos B in early October 2022, when the asteroid system will be within 11 million kilometers, or 6.8 million miles, of Earth. At this distance, the ground-based telescopes and planetary radar will be able to observe and measure the change in momentum imparted to the moonlet. Using an onboard targeting system developed by Johns Hopkins University Applied Physics Lab, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test will then aim itself at Didymos B and strike the smaller body at a speed of about 5.95 kilometers per second, which is about 3.7 miles per second. Both the spacecraft and the ground-based observatory will then verify that Didymos B has been pushed off course. Double Asteroid Redirection Test, scientists want to understand the nature of asteroids by seeing how representative bodies react when impacted, with an eye towards applying that knowledge in our world is faced with the need to deflect incoming objects. Let me drop for a second. In addition, the Double Asteroid Redirection Test will be the first planned visit to a binary asteroid system, which is an important subset of near-Earth asteroids and one we have yet to fully understand. The DART mission is managed by the Planetary Missions Program Office at Marshall Space Flight Center as part of NASA's Planetary Defense Coordination Office. Established in 2016, the Planetary Defense Coordination Office is responsible for finding, tracking, and characterizing potentially hazardous asteroids and comets, issuing warnings about possible impacts, and assisting with plans for government-led responses to actual impact threats. This could be a step for a global asteroid defense system, but start somewhere. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is, as always, AC2GS.
Yeah, this is WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Yeah, that sounds really good. You know, with the detection methods that they have, you know, hopefully in the future they'll be able to know that something is coming this way, and they'll know it if it's far enough away. Because that would work as long as it's far enough away. You know, you're not going to get much of a change, especially on a bigger asteroid. We'll get some kind of a change, direction of where it's going. The earlier they could do it, the better chance they would have. You know, if it got in close, all bets are off. You know, you wouldn't have enough mass to do anything. It was very good. I like the SEP program, the rocket, the solar electric propulsion system that Dawn had. The same, okay, that's the same setup that they're using for that Mercury mission that I mentioned before. Exactly the same design from the Dawn spacecraft. Sounds good, Roy. Yeah, thanks for that. I'll be following that, the Dawn mission.
What I'm not quite clear on, Roy, is what is the method of actually changing the trajectory of the asteroid? Are we going to impact it at a certain velocity with a mass? In other words, we're going to shoot something at it as a method of redirecting it. Over to you.
Yep, that's the plan. It's going to land on the bigger of the two asteroids, point itself to the other asteroid, take off and bang into it, and then we'll figure out how much momentum we've transferred from that little experiment. It's not going to save the world, but like I said before, you got to start someplace.
So the spacecraft that does the impacting, I presume it becomes destroyed. Is that true?
Yes, I would assume that this is a one-shot type of a deal. It probably has some kind of remote sensing devices that indicate what happens as it gets crushed. But I assume they intend to pretty much crush it.
And you got to hope that you hit near the mass center. If you hit at one edge, you just send the asteroid into a spinning motion and don't do as much redirecting. So it's got to be a pretty accurate shot as I see it. You got to hit the mass center. Any other method, like trying to mount a rocket on the asteroid, is not going to work because every asteroid is probably slowly tumbling. Therefore, your rocket engine is not going to be always directed in one direction.
Yeah, that's the big problem with things like asteroids. They're not that big, and they can spin and have all kinds of interesting angular momentum that you have to deal with. So I guess they figured collision, it's not high science. It's kind of simple kinetics, but it's proof of concept. You know, if they actually see that the momentum changes, be able to do a better version next time, and if they don't right this time, they could plan for a better way of detecting the center of gravity the next time. So, you know, anything that might someday protect us from meteorites falling out of the sky and killing us like they killed the dinosaurs, if that's what happens, I'm for.
On some of the science fiction movies, we bring an atomic weapon up to a asteroid and blast it. In reality, that probably would not be very effective, as we discussed once before. Over to you, Roy. KQIW.
Yes, but it makes for a good movie, and that's all they really care. I guess, theoretically, if you could land on the darn thing, if you could then drill down or robotically drill down with core and drop a nuclear bomb into its core, you might split it in half and divert it if you do it far enough away from us so that it misses us by a long shot. But just kind of blowing up a bomb you know, unfortunately, movies and the average person who pays to see movies just likes the things to see things blow up.
Even with that technique that you just described, drilling a hole and dropping a nuclear device down there and blasting it, that might not give you a blast. It'll give you a whole lot of heat. You'll melt the core, but you may not split the asteroid, and you may not propel it in any other direction. The majority of that blast you get from a nuclear weapon is the fact that you've heated the air, and the air expands and makes a shockwave. At that asteroid, there is no air. You're not going to get a shockwave, as I see it, Roy.
I agree with you. You're not going to get a shockwave, but I don't know. If you release a great deal of intense radiation heat in a structurally not strong fault line, it might be enough to split something in half.
It might, but I don't think it's going to I don't think it's going to propel it in any other direction. Splitting it in half just takes your single problem and now makes it two problems.
It depends, I think, upon how far away you actually do it, because momentum has to be conserved. So the two objects are not going to travel along the same exact path separated as they did when they were together. So, again, it depends upon if you could get it, if you could do it far enough away where that shift in its end position is outside our orbit. But, you know, all I can say is it makes good for movies, but I think there probably is more results than just bashing it with a rocket engine.
So the technique is going to be used that you have a certain number of kilograms of mass moving at a certain number of meters per second, and you're going to impact it at the, hopefully, the mass center, and that's the method of redirecting the asteroid. And that spacecraft that does that work, I presume it's got to be navigating all the way down to make sure it hits the center of the target, so to speak.
People call.
Roy, Sam standing by.
Pushing for Paul.
Yeah, I'm still here. WS2N.
US.
Roy, KA2NSH standing by.
Do you have a further question?
Yeah, I should come back to Dick, but I think it's okay. We're running out of time. Go ahead. What's the call and name?
Yeah, Sam, KD2NSJ. I don't know if you ever mentioned it. By the way, hi, Richard. I don't know if you ever mentioned it, but how do we know the speed of the heavenly bodies?
I found that up. I was going back to the other station that had the question for me. So let me do that one, and then I guess we can cover heavenly bodies. The other station.
Yeah, question for Paul, KC1SAM. Let me just make sure I have it.
Oh, yeah, okay. Very good, Sam. Go ahead.
Okay, I apologize. Yeah, how do we know the speed of asteroids or, like, Venus or Mars spinning around? How do we determine the speed?
Yeah, I'm going to pick it up because his name is Sam also. Yeah, we're running out of time. Paul, with the inability of the Russians to send any astronauts up, when will the current astronauts have to abandon the space station? And can it stay up without anybody on there doing any kind of maintenance?
It can stay up there, but, you know, if something goes wrong, then, of course, you know, nobody would be there to work on it and maintain it. They constantly maintain the space station. So they're rolling the dice if they walk away from it, but do that. As far as time... for instance, you have Serena Anand, the American astronaut that's still the one American astronaut that's there. The other one is Gerst from European Space Agency and one Russian. The three people are up there now, so they're not using up many consumables. And they have 6 months' worth of stuff, food and everything, so they're okay, even if they don't get a resupply mission. They are expecting a resupply mission at the end of this month, and well, so another month from now, there's another one planned. The the new crew, if everything works out, the Russians figure out what they're doing, would be going up in December. Otherwise, they can, the lifespan of the Soyuz, when it's attached to the space station, is around 200 days. And people talk about the reason for it is, it's the hypergolic fuel is going to, you know, ruin the pipes and the tanks. That's not really true. I mean, it would happen, but it would probably take years for that to happen. The real problem is the descent module of the Soyuz is the attitude controls to control the direction, you know, how the spacecraft is sitting in space on its way down as it re-enters the atmosphere. Those attitude control jets or rockets are controlled by hydrogen peroxide, believe it or not. That's the fuel. They have a heating catalyst that separates the hydrogen and oxygen. And now, of course, you have the mixture of the two, and that's how they get their thrust. What happens is, month after month, as they stay attached to the space station, the hydrogen peroxide will actually start to do that by itself. It'll start changing from to hydrogen and oxygen.
How long? I'm curious about.
200 days. That's the limit that they give it. 200 days. So the fuel will eventually run out. Would start vaporizing. So that's the reason for it. The other option is they could actually send up a Soyuz spacecraft, unmanned, nobody in it, and they're all autonomous, and they could have it docked with the space station. They have plenty of ports for the Russians to dock with, and then they would now have a new spaceship. They could do it that way as well. Back to you, Sam.
Yeah, I got you. I knew there was a time limit. I just wanted to get it before the repeater goes down. Okay, that was my question, Casey, when SAM, I'm clear. Back to you. Thank you, Paul.
Very good. Very good, Sam. And I know the other station wants to get in there. One other quick comment is we're running out of time. Top of the hour. Rocket Lab has an Electron rocket that launches out of New Zealand. He built his old Monge complex there. Peter Beck, this billionaire that's making these rockets, has now made a contract and broken ground with a launch complex not too far from here in Wallops Island, Virginia. So that should be interesting. By the third quarter of next year, he should be able to launch his first rocket from Wallops Island. They're unmanned, but it's plenty of activity. The Electron rocket, they call it. Any other questions or comments? Sorry, Sam, I don't think we're going to make it. We're after 12 o'clock. This is WS2N. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, we're about to be cut off. That was TechNet number 1720. That was Space Report number 320. That was Science Talk number 49. 73, you all. Thank you, Roy and Paul. Good work. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye, you all. T2RIW, TechNet, Limark, we're clear.
And we'll put Sam, who didn't get his question, top of the list for the space report next week. Roy, over to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. Thank you very much, Paul. Once again, roy.ac2gs.com is the web links, and mailbag at ac2gs.com is the email address, and we pretty much kind of discussed that months and months ago. AC2LR kind of asked the same question, but we'll cover it. Me and Paul will try and cover it for you again next Sunday, one time, right?
We have the space report. Come on, second.
We can't play that one by ear. We see how it goes. We never know. We'll find out.
W2BZ, KC1SAM, still there, Richard? W2BZ, KC1SAM.
The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater system. Net tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. W2VL amateur radio repeater system. W2VL repeater system. Welcome to the W2VL repeater. Thank you. tonight at 8:30 WQVL repeater system. Tonight at 8:30. Welcome to the WQVL repeater. Thank you.